Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam,
Warsaw,
Bucharest.
A very warm welcome to this latest edition of Network Europe. Coming up on the program this week, Polish elections are shaping up to be a tight race.
The Law and Justice has been focusing on the fight against corruption since the beginning of the campaign. And the Civic Platform couldn't find that one element of the campaign they could build their support in the society. And I think they have just found it, talking about the second Ireland and another miracle in Europe, trying to convince Poles that they also deserve an economic miracle.
We'll also look at new EU sanctions on Burma, how the Balkan countries are faring on their road to EU membership, and a new master's degree aims to ensure the Holocaust never slips from living memory. All these stories and more coming up on Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading broadcasters. This week, coming to you from Bonn, Germany, I'm Barbara Gruber. This week, the European Union stepped up pressure on the military regime in Myanmar, which is called Burma by the Democratic Opposition. For a decade now, the EU has imposed sanctions on Burma, including a travel ban on leading politicians, a freeze on their assets, and a trade ban with large state companies. Now, EU foreign ministers have ramped up sanctions to stop the import of Burmese wood products, timber, minerals, and precious stones. But not petrol and gas, an important source of revenue. One of the main foreign companies doing business in the country is the French oil company Total. RFI's Sarah Elzis has more on this trade-off between economics and human rights.
The French petrol company Total signed a contract in 1992 to run the Yadana gas field off the coast of Burma, along with Chevron and a Thai company. They've been pumping gas there since 2000, so why is their presence there a human rights issue?
Every year, it's an important source of revenues for the junta.
Frédéric de Beaumy of Info Birmanie, a French organization that supports the democracy movement in Burma.
In 2006, it was 350 billion euros. Total is not able to control what the junta will do with its revenues. So, of course, we know that it's not for health care or education, but it's to help military control. So, of course, Total is complicit.
Burma is ruled by a military junta that brutally shuts down any opposition. At the end of September, the government cracked down violently on protesters led by the country's monks, killing at least 10 people. In reaction, the European Union this week announced sanctions to cut off what the French Foreign Minister Bernard Kouchner called the country's, quote, main source of revenue, wood, precious stones, and metals. Conspicuously absent from all of this is gas and petrol. Olivier de Schutter, General Secretary of the International League of Human Rights, who's in Brussels, says there are two explanations.
One is the optimistic reading that they want to still have a bargaining chip to use in order to impose further sanctions. The pessimistic reading, however, is that once again, economic interests have prevailed above the need to have a very strong political action. I fear that in this case, the reason why we've targeted certain sectors and not gas and petrol is because Total is present. And I fear that this is again realpolitik as usual.
Real politics as usual. French President Nicolas Sarkozy called for no new investments by Total in Burma. He didn't say they should stop production, though. The Foreign Affairs Commission in the French Parliament called Total's general manager, Christophe de Margerie, in for a hearing on Wednesday afternoon to find out what their plans were. Axel Poniatowski of the ruling UMP party is the head of that commission.
He confirmed that there won't be any new investment in the country, but at the same time that he will maintain the exploitation of the gas. I think at the present time it is the right attitude to do.
Poniatowski says politics, not sanctions, are the way to pressure the military to negotiate with the pro-democracy opposition.
I don't believe that we should immediately reinforce the sanction heavily toward Birmania, because I think that the population will be the first to suffer.
Total has used this argument to defend itself, that it's in fact helping the population because economic development goes hand in hand with human rights. It's been battling controversy in Burma for a while. In a 2005 deal, it paid 5.2 million euros to villagers who claimed they were used as forced labor during the building of the Yadna pipeline. Total has maintained a policy of neutrality towards the government. The company declined to comment for this report, but on its website, it devotes an extensive section refuting claims that is complicit with human rights abuses. It describes health and education programs that it sponsored in the country and argues that pulling out would just make room for another company with less of a social conscience.
That's probably true. They would be replaced if they left. It is also probably true that they would be replaced by Chinese or perhaps Indian or Thai companies. However, this is ethically a very poor argument because it's not a justification for being complicit in human rights abuses that others also are complicit in the same abuses.
So the controversy comes down to whether or not France should agree to sanctions against its economic interests in order to promote human rights elsewhere.
I think in the past it was two things at the same time, to be sure that Total's investment was okay, and on the other hand, criticize the junta's roadmap. It was not very logical. So now at the time, I think France has to make a decision.
For Green Party MP Noël Mamère, the answer is clear. France should first respect human rights.
It's a principle. It's a moral principle. We cannot give moral lessons at all of the world and still going on with Total in Burma. They have to leave Burma.
Some NGOs are suggesting an alternative. Total could put revenues into a blocked account run by the international community to be used for the people of Burma. But ultimately, sanctions in whatever form from France and the European Union are weakened by the fact that China and Thailand, main investors in the country, are not on board yet with global sanctions.
RFI's Sarah Elzis with this report on the new EU sanctions on Burma. Another decision EU ministers took on Monday in Luxembourg was to sign a new agreement with Montenegro, the world's newest state, which seceded from its union with Serbia in May 2006. The Stabilization and Association Agreement is a first step on the road to EU membership. Our EU correspondent Nina Maria Potts joins us on the line from Brussels to tell us what significance this new agreement has for Montenegro.
Well, I think it's a very important first step towards EU membership, but it is only a first step. The Stabilization and Association Agreement, it's called the SAA. It's very good news for Montenegro's trade relations with the EU. It's a very, very small state. It's only got 650,000 inhabitants. As you know, it broke away from Serbia in May last year. And ever since that happened, basically, talks with the EU have really picked up. Of course, it's not yet an official candidate for EU membership, but the Enlargement Commissioner, Olli Rehn, has held it up, I think, this week as something of a model. He said he hoped other countries in the region would be inspired by Montenegro's progress. So I think that's a very positive signal from the EU.
So how quickly could we see Montenegro join the European Union? And what will be maybe the biggest challenges on the road to EU membership?
Well, Montenegro wants to launch its official application for EU membership in the first half of next year, in the first half of 2008. But there are a lot of problems ahead, namely it's the issue of reforms, bringing the country into line with EU standards. There's a very strong sense in Brussels that it wouldn't be ready to join before 2015. But again, I mean, I return to Olli Rehn. He's been very positive, saying that this was an important milestone. There may be lingering problems, but the Western Balkans are steadily making progress towards the EU.
Now, the European Union was scheduled to sign a similar agreement with Serbia. Why has this been postponed?
Mainly because of the war crimes general on the run, Ratko Mladic, whom Serbia has failed to hand over yet again. The EU essentially wants results on that case. EU membership is linked to how Serbia delivers on the UN War Crimes Tribunal. That's headed up, obviously, by Carla Del Ponte. And she said, again, that progress has been very slow and lacking in resolve.
But Nina, last week Serbia offered a 1 million euro reward for information leading to the arrest of Mladic and was expecting actually a much more positive report. Do you think the EU is focusing too much on the UN War Crimes Tribunal?
Well, I think that would certainly be Serbia's argument, and it is extremely frustrated, I think, that the EU does put so much value and links it so wholly to the UN War Crimes Tribunal. I don't see that the EU really has any other option. I mean, the way that the EU operates in these cases, especially in the case of Serbia, is that it has certain, you know, carrots and sticks, and the deal is if you get the carrot, you get the carrot, you know, once you've responded to the stick. And Serbia, time and time again, appears not to be delivering on its promises. It doesn't seem to be responding to the stick. The way that officials have put it to me is that they want to make sure that Serbia is serious, given its past. that there needs to be a trust relationship before this relationship can go forward.
Now, Kosovo is also a very tricky issue when you talk about Serbia. The future of the breakaway province of Kosovo is not formally linked to Serbia's EU accession. But what impact do you think would an independent Kosovo have on Serbia-EU relations?
Well, I think that's the million-dollar question. I think an independent Kosovo would have very significant ramifications on the whole EU-Serbia relationship. There's a deep sense of unease in Brussels as to how the Kosovo question pans out. I think there's a degree of spin as well when it comes to, you know, the whole question of unity over Kosovo, EU solidarity, unity over Kosovo vis-a-vis Russia. There's a sense that, you know, even though there are skeptic countries, Greece and Cyprus take a very different line on Kosovo, the hope is that the other skeptics will be persuaded. So on the question of unity, I think that there is a certain degree of optimism that unity will evolve. What action then follows? I think the EU obviously looks to the UN Security Council, but it's absolutely true that, you know, an independent Kosovo, let alone the process of actually getting there, is very sensitive, and how Serbia reacts to that, I think, will, as much as anything, determine how the EU tackles it.
Looking a bit wider, we always tend to lump the Balkans together. How do the EU prospects look for the other Balkan countries?
I think it's very true. We do always lump the Balkans together, and we shouldn't. In terms of prospects for the other countries, I mean, this sort of speedy rundown, Slovenia, you know, it's taking over the next EU presidency. Croatia started accession talks 2 years ago when it handed over a war crimes fugitive, General Gotovina. It's got some, you know, very big issues to solve: crime, corruption, minority rights, and so on. Macedonia, it's been a candidate for nearly 2 years, but we've actually got no accession date set yet. The EU wants to see how far it gets with reforms. You know, Albania is ticking along, but there have been very few developments on the EU front since last year. I think the one that is really lagging behind is Bosnia-Herzegovina. And, you know, it started the SAA talks 2 years ago, but there are a lot of ethnic reform problems that the EU wants Bosnia to tackle, and a whole heap of other reforms to get through. And I think Bosnia is clearly last in line.
You mentioned Slovenia taking up the rotating EU presidency on January 1st next year. Given the recent history of instability, ethnic tension and corruption in the Balkans, how much influence can a small country like Slovenia have in pushing the EU hopes of its neighbours?
I think the answer is not much, but it still has a role to play. I think among, you know, the heavyweight countries, the view is that Slovenia won't achieve very much. I've had diplomats here tell me that everyone knows that nothing's going to get done during the Slovenian presidency, so they've just accepted that, and everyone's now waiting for France. I think that's the cynic's view. I think it's clearly a big deal for Slovenia. It's been working very hard to get its turn at the helm. It may be too early, you know, to tell how its presidency will go. I think the big test for Slovenia is how it handles the Kosovo issue with a pending, you know, December deadline, and I think that it does have an important role to play there. And I think it'll be very interesting to see how Slovenia, you know, reacts to that rather sticky situation.
Nina Maria Potts with this week's Briefing from Brussels. Now, for the seventh time since the collapse of communism in 1989, Poles are about to elect a new parliament. The vote comes 2 years early, following the implosion of the current coalition in August. Many voters are still undecided over which party to support, and opinion polls show an even split between the ruling Law and Justice Party of Prime Minister Jaroslaw Kaczynski and the opposition pro-European Civic Platform. Michal Kubicki from the Polish Radio External Services has the details.
This election is seen by most Poles as a referendum on 2 years of rule by the Conservatives. In the first weeks of the campaign, they appeared to be very successful in presenting themselves as the only force genuinely committed to fighting corruption. And Prime Minister Jarosław Kaczyński strengthened his image of a man who, as Mariusz Jomecki of Superstacja Television says, likes the Poles as they are.
He likes the Polish nation as it is. He likes the Poles as they are, with all our features, all our quirks and special attitudes and unruly way of doing things and chaotic, and things that to others may seem shallow or problematic, to Jarosław Kaczyński are the core of Polish identity. and many voters sense it and like it. While the group that advocates accelerated reform and so-called modernization tends to be critical of the Polish soul.
In the final stage of the campaign, however, the opposition gained momentum. Civic Platform leader Donald Tusk emerged the victor of his television debates against both Prime Minister Kaczyński and the ex-communist president Aleksander Kwaśniewski, now the main face for the lead coalition, a mixture of his colleagues from the communist camp and left-leaning Solidarity activists. On both occasions, Tusk was better prepared and more comfortable. According to Marek Magierowski of Rzeczpospolita, Tusk's visit to Polish communities in Ireland proved a turning point in his campaign.
The Law and Justice has been focusing on the fight against corruption since the beginning of the campaign. And the Civic Platform couldn't find that one element of the campaign they could build their support in the society. And I think they have just found it, talking about the Second Ireland and another miracle in Europe, trying to convince Poles that they also deserve an economic miracle.
If Kaczyński loses this election, he will continue to be one of the key players in Poland's political scene. As an opposition leader, he will have the backing of his brother, the president. For Tusk, however, this election is to be or not to be in politics. Marcin Sobczyk, Warsaw Bureau Chief of Interfax Central Europe.
Tusk is fighting for his life. If he loses this election, he will most probably have lost presidential chances for 2010. Presidential bid, of course, is his biggest dream. He's lost to Lech Kaczyński by only several hundred thousand votes in 2005. And I think that everything that he's doing is aimed at the presidential campaign of 2010. But if he loses the parliamentary election, it will mean that he has lost his third election battle in a row. And effectively, I think we're going to see the end of Donald Tusk as an important figure.
2 years ago, Tusk's Liberal Civic Platform was tipped as an almost 100% winner. This time, too, opinion polls should be taken with a pinch of salt. Marek Magierowski again.
We had that surprise 2 years ago when the polls indicated that the Civic Platform would be the winner. And then it turned out that the Law and Justice regained the lead in the last week and it won the election. And I think that the groups of voters are very unstable. There is such a strong and unpredictable movement of voters between various parties and various groups. There are still many people who are undecided, and they say they don't know whom they are going to vote for.
One thing is certain. Building a government coalition will not be an easy task. Of the two main rivals, the Civic Platform has no doubt more potential partners.
Michael Kubicki reporting from Warsaw on the upcoming snap elections on Sunday. As the years pass, the tragedy of the Holocaust, now more than six decades ago, is starting to fade from living memory. The last survivors and eyewitnesses are dying, and there are concerns that communicating the scale of the Nazi genocide and its importance to current and future generations will become ever more difficult. To try and counter that, the Berlin campus of a Jewish American university has put together Germany's first master's degree dedicated to communicating the Holocaust to the public. This week, the seven master students attended their first seminar. Deutsche Welle's Kyle James was there.
It's the first day of Touro College's master's program in Holocaust communications and tolerance. The seven students around the table in this seminar room are in their 30s and 40s. They've already got university degrees, but want to go further with their studies, to specialize. And for the next 2 years, they'll be researching the murder of 6 million Jews by the Nazis and learning how to relate that story to a public that's either forgetting it or thinks it's heard enough already. The students all have their own reasons for enrolling in this degree program, some very personal. Lisa König-Hauff's grandfather was a German soldier who died in the war. While she's always had an interest in the topic, she says it's crucial to keep finding new ways to bring the information to the masses.
Im Zuge dessen, dass die letzten Zeitzeugen aussterben,
because on the one hand, the eyewitnesses are dying out, so we need to be able to tell the individual stories. which I think makes more sense than relating simple facts. And we need to learn to use the new media possibilities to tell about this event.
The school is a small, private Jewish-American college in a leafy residential section of Western Berlin. The idea for the program was hatched several years ago when talk began in Germany about Holocaust fatigue. Some wondered if it was time to put a little less focus on the events from what to some seemed so long ago. Younger people were increasingly finding it harder to relate to the event, according to Wolfgang Benz, director of the Center for Antisemitism Research at Berlin's Technical University.
Man muss nur Schüler fragen, die sofort sagen, ja, das wissen wir.
You just have to ask students who'll immediately say, yeah, we know all that already. And there's a sense among some in the public that on television you see just things about the Holocaust, and on the radio it's just Holocaust all the time. There's a certain defensive attitude now.
And to Andreas Nachama, director of the new Holocaust Institute at Touro College, that meant it was time to take another look at how information about the genocide was being communicated and perhaps rethink it.
Jeder, der schon mal in einem Gedenkort gewesen ist, weiß, dass dort die...
Those who work on Holocaust exhibitions often present everything they know to the visitor. Now that can overwhelm people who in the end don't know what they should look at and absorb. They end up leaving empty-handed. That's one of our key points, to find the right amount of information to communicate.
And in the right way. For a 21st century public, used to the internet and multimedia, dry recitations of facts and figures are going to be less effective, especially for young people.
Liba Locici was born in Praga, a suburb of the Polish capital, Warsaw.
At the exhibition at Berlin's Holocaust Memorial, recordings tell of the fates of individuals who lost their lives because they were Jewish and strike an emotional tone with visitors. The Touro College program wants to explore similar ways to communicate the events in exhibitions, publications, and in the media. Students will take a close look at a wide range of Holocaust-related material, everything from Charlie Chaplin's 1940 Hitler satire, The Great Dictator, to internet offerings today. They'll also study theoretical aspects of memory and remembrance and get practical training. They'll have a recording studio at their disposal where they can work with their own material from eyewitnesses. Ingo Lohse is a professor who looks at the economic aspects of the Third Reich and the Holocaust. He hopes his students will uncover new information during their research. He says there's still a lot to learn.
The connections between entrepreneurs, German companies, and so on, in exploiting, in looting, not only Jewish, but predominantly Jewish property, and so on. This discussion has begun, well, roughly 10 or 15 years ago, and it's still an open field to be discussed.
One student, Guy Bond, brings a different perspective than the others. He's from Israel and said he wanted to study how the Holocaust is perceived differently in Germany than in his home country. He says while the Holocaust took place more than 60 years ago, we can still draw lessons today.
Taking examples from the Holocaust and comparing it to today's lives, I think it's very important to see what can go wrong, where can it be radicalized, and where do we need to put the finger and say stop? That point we are not acceptable.
In this first seminar, students will study the beginnings of anti-Jewish laws under Hitler, all the way to the industrial murder sites like Auschwitz. The next 2 years won't be easy on the psyche, surely. But as the events fade in time, and those who experience them pass away, these students say the need for Holocaust specialists who make sure the story gets told in ways that are relevant to people today will only increase. For Deutsche Welle Radio, I'm Kyle James in Berlin.
And over to the Czech Republic now. In spite of all its beauty, this country is turning into a rather unpleasant place to live, at least in some respects. Two-thirds of Czechs are currently gasping for air as it gets more and more polluted. This and many other alarming facts have been highlighted in an annual report on the Czech environment, published by the Environment Ministry. Radio Prague's Ruth Frankova has the details.
According to the government report on the environment, the Czech Republic is lagging behind other European countries in a number of key areas. One of the most disturbing finds is that 62% of Czechs currently breathe air containing excess levels of soft dust particles. As a result, the number of children suffering from allergies has almost doubled in the past 11 years. Jiří Hradec of the Czech Environmental Information Agency outlines the main problems addressed in this year's survey.
We are experiencing big problems with the quality of the air, I mean, especially in the fields of particle matters. And we are not able to stop increase in greenhouse gas emissions. We have more and more trucks on the roads, and the transportation is going higher and higher towards the streets and roads. The energetic demand of our industry is ever increasing. We still have problems with waste management in communities.
Whereas in the past the problem of air pollution was limited to towns, now it also affects the countryside, especially the forests.
Prague and Ostrava are the worst hit cities in the Czech Republic, and this is caused by two most important aspects. First one is the heavy industry in Ostrava region, and the other one is heavy transportation in Prague. If you happen to go to Moravia, especially to the northern part where is the city of Ostrava, you can even touch, even smell the particle matters, the dust in the air. This is really heavily affected area.
According to environmental specialists, a more targeted approach is needed. One of the problems that should be tackled first is transportation. Among other things, they would like to introduce stricter technical controls and road taxes giving preferential treatment to cars using cleaner types of fuel. Despite the bleak data, Jiří Hradec says people can do a lot on a daily basis, such as using public transport instead of cars and switching from coal burning to gas heating. There is also at least some good news. At the very least, most Czechs care more about the environment than they used to.
Just consider the number of companies who are being certified for EMAS, which stands for Environmental Management System, and how many people are willing to participate in the environmental positive manners, even though we still see a huge retailers providing you with plastic bags. Certain chains have decided not to. So there are many things that can be done. It's always up to people, and just be vigilant and look around you. This is what counts.
Radio Prague's Ruth Frankova with this report on the Czech environment. Well, environmental awareness certainly got a big boost last week with the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and Al Gore winning the Nobel Peace Prize. The Nobel Prizes are described as the most important civil awards in the world. Since their inception in 1901, the academic world and the international community eagerly await the announcement of the winners each year. Zara Kiris and Bill Schiller from Radio Sweden have the details.
While Alfred Nobel did not grade the prizes, from the public point of view, the most popular are the Nobel Prizes for Peace and Literature. The Norwegian Nobel Peace Prize Committee Chairman, Ole Dambolt Mears, announced the 2007 laureates.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided that the Nobel Peace Prize for 2007 is to be shared in two equal parts between the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, and Albert Arnold L. Gore Jr. for their efforts to build up and disseminate greater knowledge about man-made climate change.
This is a chance to elevate global consciousness about the challenges that we face now.
So why did the Nobel Committee pick the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and Al Gore as this year's laureates? A question Bill Schiller put to Stein Tunnesson, director of the International Peace Research Institute in the Norwegian capital, Oslo.
I think this was expected. I feel good about the choice of Al Gore, who has really made a phenomenal effort to raise the world's awareness about the threat from climate change. I also feel that it's a good choice by the committee to honor science and the role of science by awarding the prize to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, because it consists of really a pool of the world's best natural scientists in this area.
Also a boost to those using the mass media to reach the public?
Yes, and this is also essential in today's world to do in all kinds of contexts. There are, of course, some negative aspects of it, which is when you produce propaganda that distorts facts. And I know there have been attacks against Gore's film on this account because there are some inaccuracies in it. I suppose that is a certain weakness. But on the other hand, the film and the book by Gore really show his enormous respect for science and our attempts to establish the facts as he can determine them.
I see Norwegian Greenpeace, the environmental activist organization, says they're very happy with this prize and it's a big slap against American President George Bush. How do you feel about this?
I'm afraid that it might be seen that way in the United States. And I know that Al Gore's work is controversial in the United States because he was the one who persuaded Clinton to sign on to the Kyoto Protocol, although they both knew that it would not be ratified by Senate. But on the other hand, the fact that the United States signed the Kyoto Protocol was instrumental in making the agreement possible at all so that other countries could ratify it.
Have you heard the news?
No.
You've won the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Oh, crap. Well, it's been going on now for 30 years. One can get more excited.
The Swedish Academy made public its choice of the winner of this year's Nobel Prize in Literature. It went to the British author Doris Lessing.
I've won all the prizes in Europe. Every bloody one. So I'm delighted to win them all. It's a sort of the whole lot, okay? It's a royal flush.
Right. Okay. The awarding committee described her as a writer of epic poetry, of the female experience, who with scepticism, fire and visionary power has subjected a divided civilization to scrutiny. To find out more about the author, Bill Schiller talked to Anneli Duva of the Swedish Radio's cultural department, who said Doris Lessing was totally unexpected this year, but was all the same delighted about the choice.
I was totally surprised. We've been talking about her for many years and we've expected her to be one of the winners. But this year, I must say, I had forgotten about her. She was not one of the people I was thinking about, but I was very pleased to hear that she was the one chosen. Yes.
What kind of books now has she written?
Well, she has written a lot. I mean, a lot of it is based on her autobiography in different ways. She's most famous, I would say, for her series. It's five books about a young woman that she calls Martha Quest, who grows up in Rhodesia in South Africa. But she's actually her. She's Doris Lessing. And then she has written science fiction. She has written a lot of books that have become very important for the women's lib movement. And she's written a lot about politics and the state of her time, really. She's very much an author who's always in her own time and is able to measure values and describe surroundings and temperatures as far as the city and also people's temperatures and attitudes in a very interesting way. She's complex.
Not that many people would take note, but World Food Day was marked this week. It's an annual reminder that too many people in the world still go hungry, even if progress is being made in some places. But what would happen if all the food in the world was divided evenly? Would there be enough for everyone? And what would everyone actually be eating? To find out, Radio Netherlands' Maurice Laparlière went to a school in Otterland, a small village in the Dutch countryside. He went there to meet a showbiz chef with a mission.
We're starting off with a beetroot salad. We're roasting the beetroots in the oven. We're doing a horseradish cream with that, a little bit of creme fraiche through it. We're serving some watercress with it, with a little bit of an orange salad. Nice combination. The main course is, what could you say, forgotten vegetables, so vegetablomte, forgotten vegetables.
Vegetarian TV cook Andy MacDonald, originally from Manchester, England. He has chosen a range of locally grown seasonal Dutch vegetables. These products arrived on his countertop with a minimum of transport and heating.
We're doing it on different ways. So we're serving it, some of the things are roasted, some of the things are cooked, some of the things are in a confit.
And the nutritional value of this three-course meal is basically what every person on Earth could eat tonight, if we shared all the food fairly. But the question is, will that be enough for our hungry Western stomachs? Can we live on this meal?
I think we can. I think we can. I think, especially with all the flavours that are going on. I mean, most people complain the fact that they're missing something in a meal. And with these kind of vegetables, you're getting so much flavour and so much intensity that I don't think you miss anything at all.
Will it give us enough energy, for instance, enough salt, enough carbohydrates and so on?
Definitely, yeah. We're using also things like nuts and pulses, and those are very good for the proteins. So, yeah, you've got a completely balanced meal here. You could survive on this if you wanted to. You could survive on this every day.
And no, there will be no meat or fish for supper. The production of these products costs an excessive amount of energy and water. But what would a real meat lover think of Andy McDonald's meal?
I think they're going to be quite surprised. Hopefully. Yeah, that's my meaning. I think they're going to be quite surprised that you can produce a really delicious meal without using meat or fish.
All right. It's an interesting thought what you're doing. It's theoretical.
Yes.
Because the real world's different. We have to deal with trade barriers and stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that will be the big problem.
Of course, it's not a perfect world. We're also not perfect people, but you can give it a go, can't you? It's worth giving it a good go. And a bit of education doesn't go amiss.
What's your main message today? What not to do or what to do?
I would say try and use products that are available locally. Try and see what's in season. Try and use things that are available now. And not to look for things that you maybe should have used in the summer.
Do we eat too much, you think?
Yeah, of course we eat too much. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Radio Netherlands, Maurice Laparlière speaking there to the British vegetarian cook Andy McDonald. You heard the man. Eat your greens. And here comes your last chance to participate in our October quiz before we announce the winners next week. So get your pen and paper out. At the beginning of the 20th century, a dancer called Mata Hari was the star of the clubs and soirees in Paris. Her seductive performances and exotic background captivated audiences.
I was born in the holy city of Javnapatam. My father was a highly regarded Brahmin. My mother a temple dancer who died when giving birth to me at the age of 14. I grew up as a charge of the temple priests. They consecrated me to Shiva, and I was introduced to the holy mysteries of love and divine worship.
But Mata Hari was not what she seemed. Her real name was Margarete Zelle, and she was born in the Netherlands, not the Far East. During World War I, she took on another role, that of spy of the German Secret Service. But her luck ran out. On October 15, 1917, Mata Hari was executed after being exposed by French counterintelligence.
I will look the soldiers in the eye. I'm proud of my past, and I was never a spy. I was Mata Hari.
The name Mata Hari means sun, but in which language? You can email us your answer. The address is contact@networkeurope.org. Or check our webpage at www.networkeurope.org.
So magis unse.
I'm leaving you today with the Macedonian pop star Toshe Proeski, who died in a tragic car accident this week and was hugely popular all over the Balkans. On behalf of the entire Network Europe team, I'm Barbara Gruber saying goodbye and thanks for tuning in.
Of course.
Kese kachar.